Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, or MPN. And this is actually a six-part series. It starts today, and it will run monthly until June. On many different topics. And today's topic is having your voice heard, taking an active role in your care to manage your MPN more effectively. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer-related organizations and many other MPN organizations as well. And it is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 378 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Spain, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and we're really delighted to have all of you on the call today. Today's program was made possible by the Insight Corporation, and we want to thank them not just for today's program, but for this entire series, this six-part series, which will allow us to really bring you more and more information about MPNs and understanding them more. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you have received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, about the topics that will be addressed. There also is information about all of those different collaborating organizations I mentioned, their websites, their 800 numbers for you to use as additional resources and help. And they're all free. They're all the services that they provide, like Cancer Care services, are free. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to please complete that evaluation form at the end of the program today. I cannot stress enough how important your feedback to us is, because you actually help us to make these programs more helpful to everybody. You actually tell us the topics you'd like us to offer. You tell us what you thought of the program. And all of that translates into another program that's going to be better. And we take your recommendations very seriously. Indeed, this series is something that people had asked for when we started to do the programs on this topic. And many of you had given us some of these topics to offer. And so here we are. So we try very hard to implement what you suggest. And this is the beginning of 2014. And so we're planning many programs. And your recommendations and insights are very important to us in planning. Now, we have wonderful speakers today on our program, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Serdan Vistovzek, and Dr. Vistovzek is Chief Section for MPN, or Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, the Leukemia Department, Clinical Research Center for MPN, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Vistovzek is going to address treatments of MPNs, and he's going to address MF, PV, and ET. He's going to address common symptoms and treatment side effects. He's going to talk about reducing complications of MPN and also how you can know the warning signs of a potential medical emergency and what to do. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Vistovzek.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a great pleasure to join you all together again. This is very valuable form of education for all of us, as you said, in the next 13 to 15 minutes, I will try to address a part of the task for today. At the beginning, I'd like to just give a little introduction about myeloproliferative neoplasms in general. So the name derives from the description of the diseases of the bone marrow. These are chronic diseases. Myeloid stands for the bone marrow cells. Proliferative obviously means that the cells are growing without control. And neoplasms indicates that these are not normal cells. There are malignant cells that happen in a patient for one or the other reasons and took off and grow without control. Now, we talk about three different entities here. ET is essential thrombocythemia, and the name is derived from the description of the blood. There are too many platelets in these patients, although the disease is, in fact, the disease of all types of cells in that individual. Polycythemia vera, or PV, again, the name derives from the description of the blood. Polycythemia means that all cells grow, and in particular, we are worried about too many red blood cells in these patients, although many have a high white cells and platelets as well in the blood. Myelofibrosis is a little bit different. The name derives from the description of the bone marrow, where fibers develop. This is like a scar tissue that is a reaction to the presence of uncontrolled growth of malignant cells in the bone marrow, where this scarring or fibrosis really suppresses eventually the growth of the bone marrow cells and blood cells. And many patients, in fact, present with the too few cells in blood, which is contraintuitive, but that's exactly what myelofibrosis usually leads to, too few cells in the blood and bone marrow failure. Now, this is a spectrum of the diseases, and there is a potential for one to change to another one. And sometimes we have a little confusion in a clinic where patient says, I started, let's say, with high platelets, and my doctor told me 10 years ago that I have an ET, and now I need a phlebotomy, a bloodletting, to decrease my red blood cell count because now I have a PV. So do I have two diseases? No, that is the disease which change in the nature over time. This is not very common, but it happens. Also, patients with ET and PV over time, over decades, may acquire fibrosis in the bone marrow, which leads to too few cells, enlargement of the spleen that comes with the change in the nature of the disease, with not feeling well, losing weight, have a systemic symptoms of different nature than ET and PV, bone aches and pains, night sweating, low-grade fevers, and patients are said to transform to post-ET or post-PV myelofibrosis. So that's a spectrum of the diseases where there is a potential in some patients, not in too many, to change over time. The issue here that we have is that there is no one test that that would say that the one patient has ET, another PV, or myelofibrosis. There is a criteria of several factors, 4 to 5 factors for each of these diseases that needs to be fulfilled for one to be diagnosed properly with one or the other. And again, over time, things may change. Now, our scope of approach to clinical therapy in these diseases is quite different between ET and PV versus patients with myelofibrosis. In general, we consider patients with ET and PV to have a more of a benign condition where the life expectancy is pretty good, close or even equal to patients without the ET and PV. Usually, patients are diagnosed in late 60s. And the scope of the therapy is to try to prevent issues that come with too many cells in blood. Blood clotting is the main problem. In some patients, also bleeding. Patients may have symptoms from uncontrolled disease in terms of sluggish blood flow, tingling or burning in the extremities, in the fingers or toes, hypersensitivity of the skin, itching, particularly after taking a hot bath or a shower when all the blood vessels open in the skin and a lot of cells come out in the skin and you have this terrible itching that is preventing a good quality of life. Patients may be fatigued. Patients may have a blurred vision with too many cells in the blood circulation or headaches, sometimes shortness of breath on exertion. Most of these symptoms, as you can see, are related to uncontrolled blood cell count. Our attempt in these patients is usually focused on decreasing the blood cell numbers or making the blood flow easier. We usually in patients with ET, give patients to take a low so-called baby aspirin, which makes with the blood flow, which helps with the blood flow. And in some patients, usually in patients who are older than 65 or have already history of a blood clot, we implement a cytoreductive therapy. This would mean a therapy to decrease, actually, the number of circulating platelets, and in some patients that have perhaps elevated the white cells, also to decrease the white cells. The standard medications would include hydroxyurea, which is a chemotherapy agent given as a pill by mouth, in different dosing schedules. Usually we start with one pill a day. The dose is fixed because there is only 500 milligram tablets available. And we adjust the dose to decrease the platelets usually to normal levels, below 400, without invoking any toxicities. Toxicities with hydroxyurea are relatively rare. That may be, for example, a mouth sores or a sore on the skin in the ankle area, sometimes a fever episode, but overall hydroxyurea is very well tolerated and very effective. In about three-quarters of the patients, it would do a very good job. Perhaps in a quarter, completely normalize everything that bothers the patient. In about 50%, it would do a partial very good job. Only in a minority of the patients would not achieve the goal of controlling signs and symptoms. Then the alternative medication, if medications, again, are needed, not in everybody, as I mentioned, the alternative medication that is at our disposal in the clinic is called anagrelide. This medication is an inhibitor of a growth of certain cells in the bone marrow that make platelets. These are megakaryocytes. And again, it's relatively good in tolerance. It may sometimes cause palpitations or headaches or diarrhea, sometimes anemia, but usually in about three-quarters of the patients would again have a good benefit from the therapy in controlling the platelet numbers. Last medications in a commercial setting available is interferon, which is a medication. This is a natural product, actually, that is given in a larger volume to patients with ET to control the bone marrow function and decrease the blood cell production, decreasing the platelets. This medication is given as an injection, either regular interferon 3 or 5 times a week under the skin, or a long-acting interferon once a week or even less frequently. There are some issues with tolerance, unfortunately, with interferon, where it causes flu-type symptoms. And this is related to what it does usually in the body. It is a natural product. That means that we already have interferon in our body, and it comes up higher in the blood when we have inflammation or infections, and this is one of the reasons why we have those symptoms when we have infections. And if you give it as an injection, it may cause flu-type symptoms, so a number of patients may not tolerate it very well. Because it's a natural product, it's particularly useful in patients that need to control signs and symptoms of ET in pregnancy, or in young patients that need a cytoreductive therapy, because perhaps they had a clot or they have uncontrolled symptoms from ET, interferon is preferable approach. In polycythemia vera, we deal primarily, as mentioned, with the high red blood cell count. We do, again, give patients low-dose baby aspirin. Importantly, a higher dose of aspirin doesn't make much of a difference for preventing the thrombosis or making blood flow easier. Baby aspirin is enough, and patients are usually, and that's a standard practice, phlebotomized, which is a bloodletting to decrease the red blood cell count. We monitor one particular aspect of the red blood cell count measurements, which is called hematocrit. This would be our goal, to decrease the hematocrit below 45% in men and 42% in female. The medications to decrease the red blood cell count and platelets and white cells in those that have those elevated as well are again indicated in patients that are older than 65 or had a history of thrombosis in the past, and we use either hydroxyurea or interferon as the first-line therapy. One or the other can be tried. They are very good in what they do, particularly low-acting or slow-acting interferon has been more recently shown to be effective in controlling signs and symptoms in about 80 to 90% of the patients. Hydroxyurea has been around for decades, and its benefits are at the same level as in ET. Great majority of the patients benefit without too many side effects. We therefore focus, as you can see, on controlling the disease. We have no medication to really eliminate it. We try to prevent the issue of having too many cells causing thrombosis. We try to control the symptoms that I mentioned that are similar in ET and PV. We have no need to be more aggressive. Let's say I have a question many people ask me whether we would perhaps try to eliminate disease with the bone marrow transplant. That's unnecessary because this is too aggressive approach, and we do very well with the control of the signs and symptoms of the disease. There is a potential for ET or PV to transform to myelofibrosis, as I mentioned before, in some patients, or even very rarely to acute myeloid leukemia. For us, it's very hard to predict at the beginning whether one patient will or will not experience during their life such a transformative event. The best way to look at the patients is to follow patients over time and learn about the behavior of the disease and follow a trend in a change of blood cell count and signs and symptoms of the disease, including, as I mentioned, enlargement of the spleen or development of new symptoms that have not been previously present, or developing of anemia that is not related to the therapy. That would indicate that there is a change to perhaps myelofibrosis. In terms of the bone marrow biopsies, many people ask about the need for those. We usually advocate a bone marrow biopsy at the beginning of evaluation of a patient that has a suspected ET or PV to really establish very well characteristics of the disease in terms of the number of cells in the bone marrow, a number of baby cells called blasts, any change in the chromosomes, which are structures in the cells that carry genes, or even test for some genetic abnormalities that may come with these malignant cells, and establish the degree of fibers. These things may change over time, and we don't usually advocate a frequent bone marrow biopsies to monitor the disease. If the disease is meant to change, then it will be shown in the blood, in enlargement of the spleen, in the types of white cells that are present in the blood, in anemia, in the symptoms. And then if we witness such a change, then there is a need to address a possible change in bone marrow and repeat it. Many worry about acquisition of fibers in bone marrows if they have ET and PV over time. Having a fibers at certain level may even be present in normal people. Or a change in the fibers if there is a repetitive bone marrow biopsy done, let's say, 10 years after the initial one. If there is a more of fibrosis there, that doesn't really mean that there is a change to myelofibrosis. As I mentioned very at the beginning, and it's important to repeat it, for each of these entities, ET, PV, or myelofibrosis, we have certain criteria that would fulfill a diagnosis, and there are criteria for post-ET or post-PV myelofibrosis as an entity. Presence of the fibers does not mean the patient has myelofibrosis. The complications that are related to blood clotting are usually addressed with aspirin, hydroxyurea, interferon, or anagrelide, as mentioned. But it is important for patients to get to know what the disease complications possibly are and address other contributing factors to increase risk of clotting. High blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, smoking, these types of, and others, types of medical problems or habits that we have that may contribute to increased risk of thrombosis are important to be addressed, to be diminished or eliminated as such to decrease the risk of a blood clotting, because which presence of these multiple risk factors for thrombosis, obviously, we are talking then about high-risk patient for having a blood clot. One interesting fact that I'd like to mention about the high platelets. Platelet number on its own is not a risk factor for a blood clot. I haven't mentioned it so far because age and history of blood clot are remaining and the most important factors. Some worry about elevated white cells as a factor for clotting. This has been shown in retrospective studies to perhaps contribute to risk of clotting, but it's not yet ready for prime time use. But let's go back to the high platelets. High platelets are of a concern if they are really very high. Some would say about 1.5 million to 2 million or higher, because at that point in time there is increased risk of bleeding, which is counterintuitive, but it's actually the case. These very high platelets would consume some proteins, and one of the significance that we always talk about is so-called von Willebrand factor. This factor is important for blood clotting, and too many platelets would diminish it and make people prone to bleeding. Therefore, we consider, not as a rule, but we consider patients that have a very high platelets, 1.5 million or higher, to be at a risk of bleeding. And in that case, the medications are given to decrease risk of bleeding, not to decrease risk of clotting. And many, if they have 2 or 3 million platelets, may not need the aspirin because of von Willebrand factor deficiency. They are all already at the risk of bleeding, and adding aspirin in this situation may not be good at all. This is important from everyday practice because some physicians and patients are over-concerned about having a 700 or 900 or 1100 platelet numbers in the blood, but pretty much no difference in terms of a clotting risk. In terms of medical emergencies in these diseases, in ET and PV, we have clotting issues that may affect the lungs or the heart or the brain. Obviously, people with perhaps clotting in the lungs, this is pulmonary embolism, would be acutely short of breath with their chest pains, dizzy because no enough oxygen, requiring a visit to emergency room. Those that affect the heart and the brain obviously would lead to an emergency right away. Another one that is important to recognize is enlargement of the lower extremities in the calf area where there is a possibility of having a deep venous thrombosis that would require therapy with anticoagulation to make blood flow easier because of potential of these clots to dislodge and end up in the vital organ of the body and then cause even more harm. Bleedings are less common, but one of the more serious problems is with enlargement of the blood vessels around the GI tract, in the esophagus, in the upper part of the stomach as well, where those vessels are usually in patients that have uncontrolled polycythemia vera, for example, engorged and enlarged, they may burst and bleed, and patients will have then significant lowering blood pressure, not feeling well, and would need to go emergency room. Myelofibrosis is much more aggressive disease, which presents usually with a low blood cell count, enlargement of the spleen, and very poor quality of life, with life expectancy on average about 5 to 7 years. Clinical aspects are quite different and easy to recognize in many patients, although some patients are in transition, as I mentioned before, from ET or PV to myelofibrosis, and perhaps not easy to dissect where the patient stands in the aggressiveness of the disease. And there are obviously patients that have early myelofibrosis that are not that sick, but the tendency is for this disease to be more aggressive than ET and PV. Here we focus on dealing with enlargement of the spleen, enlargement or a decrease in the red blood cell count, anemia, and very poor quality of life with decreased ability to walk, cachexia, meaning weight loss, bone action pains, night sweating, and others. We have one medication approved as a therapy for myelofibrosis. This is Jakafi, which is an oral medication, a JAK inhibitor that is taken twice a day, which in great majority of the patients would improve the enlargement of the spleen. It would also improve quality of life significantly in majority of the patients by virtue of making them eat more, improve ability to walk, eliminate night sweating, itching, bone aches and pains, and others. It works in a great majority of the patients for a long period of time, and it seems that even in patients with advanced features may prolong their life. There are a number of papers now published showing that with very good control of signs and symptoms of the disease, we prevent progression of the disease, prevention in terms of preventing bigger and bigger spleen, bigger and bigger liver, which also can be enlarged, preventing the weight loss, cachexia, and maintain the good control of the disease for a longer period of time, which ultimately leads to prolonged survival. I would perhaps at this point in time move on to the next speaker. Dr. Mauro is joining us here as well from New York. Well, thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Vistovic. That was a very comprehensive overview of MPN and MF, PV, and ET, and just really giving a lot of the important medical information that everybody needs to have in terms of their understanding the importance of really taking care of this disease, getting the proper care, and also bringing their questions to their doctor. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. And Dr. Morrow is leader, Myeloproliferative Diseases Program, member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Morrow is going to continue and talk about key concerns to discuss with your doctor and healthcare team, becoming proactive in talking with your physician about your specific concerns and symptoms, and when to call your doctor between appointments, if that's okay to do, keeping a journal of symptoms and side effects to report to your doctor, and how being more assertive may actually improve the care and quality of your life. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to join you today to talk about myeloproliferative disorders, and I think we've just heard a most excellent overview from Dr. Vistovic about what these diseases are like and really how complicated they can be, how some of the symptoms may develop, and while there are many similarities, as these are a family of conditions, generally talking about overproduction or overactivity of the marrow, they're treated in different ways. There are different symptoms and problems which required certain therapies to be focused on, and clearly there have been some terrific advances. I think many of you are hopefully aware of some of the dramatic advances that my colleague Dr. Vistovic championed with the development of targeted therapies, the JAK inhibitors, which are oral twice-a-day drugs, which have dramatically changed the way we're able to treat some of the main symptoms and side effects of particularly myeloid fibrosis, and we're beginning to understand how we might be able to treat some of the related conditions like polycythemia and perhaps even ET at some point. And which brings me to my first point. One of the most important things to understand when you're diagnosed with such a condition is, what is this disease? And I often find with consultations that one of the most important visits is just to sit down and unravel the disease, ask someone what they know, and then fill in the gaps. And, of course, looking for an expert or someone who has a great breadth of knowledge about the disease is always helpful, but there are many different ways to learn about the disease, from your current doctor, from seeking input from other physicians, from the literature, from the Internet, and also in perhaps enlisting or deploying a loved one or a friend or a partner in the journey, really to just help you uncover, because it's going to be overwhelming, especially early in the diagnosis, for someone to try to do a lot of research and read about complications and expectations and side effects from treatment and all that. But you do really see a lot of solace in understanding, what is this disease? How is it? What am I looking for? What kind of problems should I be on the lookout for? And then getting down deeper, what are these new therapies? Understanding, what is the JAK2 kinase? In a nutshell, what we're talking about is that we've unraveled what is at the center and what is really perhaps driving cells in our body, whether it's a young cell that develops platelets and causes scarring in the bone marrow, or a leukemia cell, or a lymphoma cell, or anything cell for that matter. We've gotten much better at understanding what switches have been thrown on and off in such cells, and we've been able to develop targeted drugs which can turn on off or modify the activity of cells in a very specific way, with a very narrow band of side effects in many cases. So if you understand what the disease is going to entail, what the therapy might bring, how it's working, it'll help you understand and help categorize questions you have to ask. A lot of people hear about genetics and chromosome abnormalities and myeloproliferative disorders or genetic testing. Ask about some of the research that's being done. This is an inherited disease. Do I need to worry about my children? Is this something that I have had for a long period of time? We're learning a bit about some inherited patterns of these diseases, or maybe predispositions, but in general, these are sporadic and diagnoses that come later in life, typically, and are not something that people have a lot of control over, or risk factors can be modified. But that being said, Dr. Vistovic can focus a lot on this, and I'd like to emphasize it as well, that enlisting the care of your own your specialist doctor, your hematologist or oncologist, but also your primary care doctor, perhaps a cardiologist if they're involved, neurologist if you've had symptoms in that arena. It's very important because another area I focus on is CML and also myeloproliferative disorders. We have to have a team approach because this condition is now very manageable, very treatable, all these diagnoses. And we're talking about a marathon, not a sprint. So looking at all your doctors and understanding what symptoms they can help you understand and when things need to be addressed urgently, as we heard a little bit about. You want to know about symptoms of the disease itself, direct complications from the side effect, from the therapy, and also direct complications from the disease and know what you might have to be on the lookout for. We talk a lot about cardiovascular symptoms, common things that people are familiar with, chest discomfort, signs or symptoms of neurologic or nerve function loss, and then some subtle things that are more disease-specific related to the flow of blood, the viscosity of the blood. Dr. Vistovic mentioned, you know, burning of the fingertips and when you take a hot bath. That's a very unique symptom or side effect that is related to this disorder and, you know, something that tips us off to making the diagnosis. In the last few moments, just noting that, you know, keeping a journal is always important. To be frank, we often have a problem when we have very treatable conditions that are very long in their natural history, which is a good thing, that we can significantly prolong people's lives and improve their survival. But taking therapy for the long haul can be very challenging. So keeping a journal is good to, A, just remind yourself of how you're doing, about how important your therapy is, about side effects and symptoms you may have, and helps us as healthcare team members understand how many doses you're struggling with, you know, in a week or in a month or in a year, for that matter. We're all human, and we're not perfect about taking medications, but cancer therapy and therapy for blood disorders like MPNs are vital, no matter what it is, whether it's aspirin or hydroxyurea or Jakafi. So knowing how you're doing and really reflecting through a journal side effects and compliance and, you know, how much are you sticking to your therapy is really important. And be honest. Again, we're all human. And then lastly, to be assertive. I think Dr. Vistovic and I would both want to encourage people to look for clinical trials. This is a very active area of research. And ask what novel treatments might be available, even if it's not necessarily a primary treatment, but something related to treatment, related to the diagnosis. When things aren't going well, looking for many different options, you know, to ask, to seek support groups, to work with wonderful patient advocacy groups like Cancer Care and others. Who help with education, educational resources, other advocacy groups which have support groups or lectures you can attend. There's a community out there, patients with these rare diseases, and they're growing larger and larger, and they're there to serve you. So I encourage you to do all those things to really take charge because, you know, we want to work as a team, and we want to really navigate with you to manage these diseases quite well. And we really have the tools nowadays, and I think it's going to be a very exciting time for patients with these conditions that we can, A, have good treatments, B, be very keen about what we're looking for, and C, make much bigger strides. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Morrow, and excellent points that you've made, and thank you. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly. Sarah is an oncology social worker, and she's coordinator of older adult services at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn. And I'd like to thank everyone on the call. I think we got a lot of really good information today. So as Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker here, and I work with many people coping with MPN and their loved ones. And we've been talking today about managing your care, and so I wanted to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and part of managing that care and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. You know, I feel like there are many ways we can help in it. So just a little bit about who we are and what we do. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We do that face-to-face in the New York City area and then over the telephone nationally. We have support groups, which we provide face-to-face in New York, over the telephone nationally, and online both nationally and internationally. We have education programs. We provide practical help. We can help you navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her support network or his or her family and friends. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes, social adjustments, the psychological impact. I think that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. The cancer experience or even, being diagnosed with MPN, it affects the whole person, your support network, your friends and families, and that's why I think support with this is so helpful. I think Dr. Morrow did an amazing job sort of talking about unraveling some of this, and where we can help is really once things unravel and helping you unravel a little bit more, putting them together in a way and organizing it in a way that makes sense to you. Asking for help, joining a support group, or, contacting a social worker for counseling is important and actually is a huge sign of strength. You really don't have to do this on your own. If you join a support group, you really are connecting with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar issues they're facing. With individual counseling, that really is a space that's yours to talk about any concerns and to bring in some of the issues. And I just feel these connections help lessen the isolation that sometimes comes with this. Dr. Morrow also talked about it being overwhelming, and especially in the beginning. We're here for that. He also said something that I liked about it being a marathon and not a sprint. This is very true, and I think it is important in that marathon that you have that support. We're here, and Dr. Morrow also mentioned other supports that are out there in the community for you. So I'm just going to talk really briefly about what we have going on right now. We have an online support group that is actually specific for people who are diagnosed with blood cancers and blood disorders. It is starting on Monday. The group runs for 15 weeks, and it's in an online format. If you're interested in registering, all you need to do is go to www.cancercare.org. You can register right there on the website. One of the things I like about the online groups is that you don't need to be in a specific place at a specific time. You have access 24/7. So, whenever you feel that need to reach out, to be talking to someone, you can get there on the group. It's great that way. We also have face-to-face groups and phone groups, which I mentioned earlier. We have two general groups that are running, face-to-face and phone, and also groups for caregivers, both face-to-face and phone. The groups actually started those last week. There is still space if you're interested in registering. Definitely contact us. You can call our HOPE line, which is 1-800-813-HOPE. Or 1-800-813-4673. You can also find out about them on our website, www.cancercare.org, and you can email us from that site also. The website I just recommend going to. It's really comprehensive. There's a lot of information, not just on support, but actually on all of our programs, as well as a lot of literature on your diagnosis, treatment, coping with the diagnosis. There's just a lot of great information there. So I'm going to wrap up. I think we've learned a lot from the program. There's a lot of information to take in and to get your arms around. We're here. If you are interested in support or just, really even just prioritizing or organizing some of your needs around this, call us. That's what we're here for. And just remember that you're not alone in this. And really, our services are here to help you. Thanks for your attention and the opportunity to talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Sarah. That was really wonderful and very, very clear about all the different services that we offer, and particularly that there's a group starting next week. So we'll mention that again to people, so you can go ahead and sign up for that if you're interested. So now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board, and then we're going to actually take as many of your questions as possible. So, Sam.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking on the Ask a Question button.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, really about the flu season. It actually came in right almost before the call started, that actually, so the question was about getting a flu shot, if that was okay, and if there's anything else that they needed to do in addition, if they could get a flu shot, and then any other precautions that they could take in terms of flu prevention. So Dr. Vistovec, would you like to address that question?
Yes. Obviously, there is no contraindication to get a flu shot. It is a valuable tool to try to decrease the risk of getting a flu. Many times, this is also asked in a different way, whether there is a mandatory need to provide a flu shot or any other vaccine to patients that have myeloproliferative neoplasms. This is particularly relevant to patients with myelofibrosis that may have more aggressive disease and therefore their immune system may be changed quite a bit from normal. Yet in everyday practice, we don't really actively pursue mandatory vaccinations of patients with myelofibrosis. If the patient is interested and willing, then in my own practice, I support that, but I don't really engage in actively pursuing that as a mandatory need for patients with MPN.
Excellent. Thank you. Now there's another question just in terms of from one of our online participants about actually a question about the caregiver, and they really appreciate the help of the caregiver, but at times they're not quite sure how to approach a caregiver who's a bit overbearing, and so wondered if they should discuss this with their doctor, how they should deal with this. So I wondered if Ms. Kelly, if you could address that to begin with, in terms of just the challenge of the caregiver and the person living with MPN.
Absolutely. So, I think one of the things to remember with this is that, with the patient, if you are the person going through this, and also with the caregiver, both of you are going through this. And it's important to remember, I think often what happens is, we tend to sort of try to imagine what the other person is thinking, worry about the other person's feelings, worry about what the other person's response is going to be. And I think maybe one of the best things you can do, definitely if you feel comfortable doing it or safe doing it, is having an open conversation about that, if you're able to. And definitely, if you can, also bringing that caregiver in to the appointment if you're concerned about information and if you feel safe bringing them in, so they also can get that information from the doctor and important information they need to know. But again, it's trying to be, I think, a little more open, more honest about what's happening for you and asking them what's happening for them so you guys can be on the same page.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other comments about that issue of just the caregiver and the person living with MPN? And actually, Sarah, could you just comment on the role of the support group or just individual mm-hmm. counseling for that in terms of, because that's such a, the question is around MPN, I think it's something we hear a lot for many cancers. So if you could just say a bit more about that.
Absolutely. So within that, sort of the idea of being more open, being on the same page, there may be times where each of you needs your own space, needs your own support with this, sort of the idea that, one person certainly can't be every role or be everything. So with the support groups for patients, for caregivers, each of you would have your space to connect with other people who are also going through this. And, we talked about it in terms of patients. I mentioned it briefly for caregivers, but also for caregivers it can be helpful because they're with other people who are also caregiving. And then the individual counseling really does give you that very specific space that is geared towards you and what's happening for you, that really that time that is your own. And that also may be important in this for you. So know that that's there for you, and it's there for the caregiver as well.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a question actually from one of our online participants, from Nancy. Is it okay to have varicose veins treated for a patient with PV? Dr. Morrow, could you address that question?
Sure. Always important to have a coordinated approach for the healthcare team. So if there's a vascular specialist that's suggesting a procedure and that there's interest, I think they have to coordinate with the hematologist. There might be a reason for an elective procedure, which that hopefully would be, to think about doing it when the polycythemia is well treated. And there's very strict or very specific guidelines around how when we think when is polycythemia in good shape. Perhaps if the phlebotomy, as Dr. Ristovic mentioned, has been done adequately, or with other medications, the hematocrit is well in target and is stable, that would be a good time. So there isn't a lot of exclusion. You know, when the blood numbers are corrected, risks can be managed quite well, and a typical patient with myeloproliferative disease can have things done, can hopefully lead as normal a life as possible, and have all the other healthcare needs that they might encounter managed. It's just that coordination that's so important, so people are talking. We wouldn't want to have someone have untoward complications because of a disease-related issue, also a treatment-related issue. And on the same token, reviewing medications and sometimes stopping medications for procedures is very important. And we often have people on antiplatelet agents like aspirin or other things that could interfere. So all that coordination is important. But the assumption would be that many things are going to be fine, but always stop first can particularly focus on doctors connecting or healthcare teams connecting and medications being known.
And we have another question from one of our participants. Do you think that cold weather, the cold weather that we've had in many parts of this country at this point, has an adverse effect on the breathing of a PMF patient? Dr. Vistovzek, could you address that?
The question was about the cold weather affecting the breathing of a patient with MPM.
Yes.
The most important factor that affects the body function is really the activity of the disease in terms of the blood cell count, and the good control of the blood cell count and associated problems that we mentioned in discussion before are paramount for one to feel well. I'm not aware of a connection between the cold weather and the difficulty breathing, in particular in patients with myeloproliferative neoplasm.
And there is another question, it asks about the metabolic pathway research and if there's any active study going on nationwide. Dr. Vistovzek, could you address this?
Yes. The underlying biological abnormalities in the myeloproliferative diseases are tied to uncontrolled cascade of proteins that are tied one to each other in the bone marrow cells and make cells grow. This is so-called JAK-STAT pathway. This is the target, in fact, for development of the JAK inhibitors, where we inhibit the growth of the cells by inhibiting this JAK-STAT pathway, and we also inhibit what is another consequence of the hyperactive JAK-STAT pathway, and that is the inflammation. We know that many inflammatory signals in our body, many proteins that attach to different cells in the body activate this JAK-STAT pathway, and in the disease, in MPN, this JAK-STAT pathway is super active in bone marrow cells, so we have a uncontrolled growth of the cells, and inflammation is at a very high level in the body. This inflammation is tied to the metabolism as well. Hypercatabolic, so-called state develops where patients lose weight. Particularly, I'm talking about patients with myelofibrosis, where with advanced stage there is an effect on the cholesterol levels, for example, that go low. There is a whole metabolic discourse in the patients that is related directly to uncontrolled activity of the disease in the bone marrow and blood. With the new medications, we try to correct those. Patients actually eat more, and the cholesterol, for example, goes up. The protein levels improve, the patient's body composition improves overall over the course of a therapy. Understanding how the disease actually through inflammation affects the metabolism is not, this is actually not very well known. There are efforts to dissect the abnormalities in these proteins, so-called cytokines in the body, that affect the body due to uncontrolled growth of the malignant cells in the body, in the bone marrow, to understand how the therapies really work and why we see these benefits with the JAK inhibitors in particular. So it's an area of significant interest because it can translate into the benefit for other patients with advanced cancer, for example. We already know that some patients with advanced cancer do benefit from JAK inhibitors by also improving the body conditions, tolerating their therapies well, and appears to be living longer. There were reports of patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer, for example, benefiting from such interventions. So we are opening the door for understanding the new aspect of the bone marrow diseases and the therapies that affect these metabolic inflammatory pathways in a different way than the therapies that we had so far.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Sama, next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Andrea W. Your line is now opened.
Yes, I would want to know what the most promising clinical trial is for an anemic MF patient on Jakafi.
Could you just repeat the question again one more time, please, Andrea?
I'd want to know what the most promising clinical trial, ongoing clinical trial, is for an MF anemic person.
Okay. Dr. Vistovzak, could you address that question?
Yes, this is a really good question, and there is no real simple answer to identify one. The field of developing new medications in myelofibrosis in particular is going toward building on what we already have achieved, for example. So there are clinical studies where medications are combined with a JAK inhibitor in order to further improve what the benefits are, so more patients to have a better control of enlargement in the organs and to feel even more energetic and gain weight and walk more than the therapy with the JAK inhibitor alone, to diminish the problem with the lowering of the platelets and red blood cells that may develop in some patients with the JAK inhibitor, to improve the anemia, which is something that doesn't happen with JAK inhibitors, or a combination studies with medications that completely do a different job, with anti-fibrotic medications that would potentially decrease the fibrosis in the bone marrow and which would, we hope, lead to improve in the production of the red blood cells, platelets, and white cells, so that we have a combined benefit of improvement in the spleen and symptoms with the JAK inhibitors and improvement in the bone marrow function with the anti-fibrotic medications. There is a number of other studies that employ novel aspects of bone marrow biology that we are learning about every day about myelofibrosis. There has been a study with imetelstat, which is a telomerase inhibitor. There is a study with different novel medications that have nothing to do really with the JAK-STAT pathway, trying to tackle the disease with a different angle. And there are studies where we combine the JAK inhibitors with the bone marrow transplant. Bone marrow transplant is the only curative procedure that we have that would potentially eliminate disease and making people more eligible and in making patients have a better body condition, a smaller spleen, and a better weight and ability to walk makes a lot of difference for the success of a transplant that follows such a, let's say, 3 or 4 months therapy with the JAK inhibitors. So a number of trials are underway around the United States, and I agree with the previous request for everybody to consider joining a different studies for us together to make a difference and make more discoveries and approve more therapies for patients with myelofibrosis.
Thank you very much. And another question from one of our online participants. I was recently diagnosed and show no symptoms. Therefore, my doctor said immediate treatment was not necessary. Should I seek a second opinion? Dr. Moore, could you address this in a general way, not having all the specifics, but just to give some general guidelines about this, and even the concept of a second opinion as well?
Sure. I actually would love to change the term second opinion to I'm seeking someone to say how they can help as well, because I'm always chagrined by that term, because it's not often that we have a different opinion. It's different people's approaches may be different, and they may have different knowledge or different advice or different views of things, but we're all advocating for people's best health and best care, but, you know, as healthcare providers, we should never be fearful or dissuading people from seeking other colleagues to comment or to help, offer how they could help or what their thoughts might be. We do it all the time naturally in our own circle, so I always tell patients to easily and readily seek second visits with other physicians to get other opinions, and honestly to be wary of someone who is discouraging you to do so. That's a bit of a bold statement, but I really feel that way. With regards to this disease set, I think there are nuances to the treatment, and sometimes we are looking at really at symptom control and symptom management, and a lot of our trials have focused on patients who had certain symptoms that we know our early information from studies showed we could impact on. So the further we know, the further we get along down the road, the more we know, I think the better we'll be able to use medications and use them earlier, more in a preventative or an earlier management strategy, but that does take some time. Naturally, we're able to, when we have a measurable thing to improve rather than just a simple diagnosis, we often have more readily willingness to prescribe treatment, but I think that is a very reasonable question to have another opinion on or another thought on or someone else to offer how they might help.
Thank you. And I want to thank all of our speakers today. They've really been outstanding, and all of you on the call have really been outstanding as well, really asking really excellent questions as well to give us some time to elaborate on other points. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And with that in mind, I do want to encourage you, if you have a question that you didn't get to ask or you have some concerns or just some need for support, to please contact our practical help to contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. We have a staff of oncology social workers here, all professionally trained, to answer and address any questions or concerns you may have. Most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with myelofibrosis, in dealing with cancer. I want you to know that you're part now of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And we are simply a telephone call away, and you do not have to wait until you have a crisis. You can call us at any time with just a question that might be troubling you or a concern you may have. We are here really to be here to help you, as are all the other organizations as well that are listed in your materials. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to remind all of you that this is a 6-part series. So there's a part 2, which is on February 26th, the importance of finding the resources you need to deal with MPN. So stay tuned. And we do have a lot of other programs that you've probably gotten materials about as well, but that one is particularly about MPN. And so there's a whole series of them, one each month. So I hope you'll take advantage of them as well. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.